even called them a blessing in disguise. In the vast majority of cases, the embryo or fetus had some kind of catastrophic defect that would have made it incompatible with life. Still, if you and your partner have a miscarriage, you probably won't find any of this particularly reassuring, and it won't make it hurt any less. Until very recently, miscarriage, like the pregnancy it ends, had been considered the exclusive emotional domain of women. Truth is, it isn't. While men don't have to endure the physical pain or discomfort of a miscarriage, their emotional pain can be just as severe as their partner's. They still have the same hopes and dreams about their unborn child. They still feel a profound sense of grief when those hopes and dreams are dashed. And many men, just like their partners, feel tremendous guilt and inadequacy when a pregnancy ends prematurely. Some good friends of mine, Philip and Elaine, had a miscarriage after about 12 weeks of pregnancy. For both of them, the experience was devastating, and for months after the miscarriage, they were besieged by sympathetic friends and relatives, many of whom had found out about the pregnancy only after it had so abruptly ended. They asked how Elaine was feeling, offered to visit her, expressed their sympathy, and often shared their own miscarriage stories. But no one, not even his wife, ever asked Philip what he was feeling, expressed any sympathy for what he was going through, or offered him a shoulder to cry on. Psychologists and sociologists have conducted many studies on how people grieve at the loss of a fetus, but the vast majority of them have dealt only with women's reactions. The ones that have included fathers' feelings generally conclude that men and women grieve in different ways. Dr. Kristen Goldbach found that women are more likely to express their grief openly, while men tend to be much less expressive, frequently coping with their grief in a more stoical manner. This doesn't mean that men don't express their grief at all or that they feel any less grief than women. Instead, it simply highlights the fact that in our society, men, like my friend Philip, have virtually no opportunity to express their feelings, at least not in the traditional way. Many men respond to their grief by doing everything they can to get life back to normal. That often means going back to work and putting in extra long hours. It's a way of getting away from the self-blame and feelings of hopelessness at not knowing how to comfort their partner. It's a way of avoiding the barrage of baby images that was probably always there but now seems much more pervasive. It's a way of coping with their grief and, unfortunately, of ignoring it. If your partner was carrying twins or more, miscarrying one does not seem to have negative implications regarding the health or genetic integrity of the surviving fetus, say Drs. Connie Agnew and Alan Klein. Miscarrying a twin may, however, put your partner at a slightly higher risk of going into preterm labor. If your partner is carrying three or more fetuses, you may have to deal with the question of what's called selective reduction. Basically, the more fetuses in the uterus, the greater the risk of premature birth, low birth weight, and other potential health hazards. Simply, and rather gruesomely put, all these risks can be reduced by reducing the number of fetuses. It's an agonizing decision that only you and your partner can make. Since 1980, the number of twin births has doubled and the number of unplanned triplets, quads, and so on has more than quadrupled. Fortunately, as ART methods improve, the trend has been slowly declining, which means that fewer and fewer couples will be faced with this heartrending decision. Trying again. If you've suffered a miscarriage and have decided to try to get pregnant again, your goal is to prepare a healthy environment for the baby to swim around in and to prevent birth defects or other complications. One of the most crucial times of the pregnancy is between 17 and 56 days after conception. That's when the organs start developing. But because this stage happens so early on, it's entirely possible that your partner might not know she's pregnant, and by the time she finds out, she may have already done all sorts of things that could affect the baby. Things she'll wish she hadn't done. For that reason, it's important to prepare yourselves for the next pregnancy as far in advance as you can. From 6 to 9 months would be great, but even a month or two can make a big difference. Preconception. The rest of this book is devoted to how to have a healthy, safe pregnancy and a healthy mom and baby. But right now, we're talking about steps you can take before your partner conceives again that can boost your chances of getting pregnant make for a less eventful pregnancy, and potentially help you reduce or avoid the expense and emotional ups and downs of fertility treatments. You never know when your partner's going to burst out of the bathroom waving a little white stick and announce, "Honey, I'm pregnant." So before the two of you hop in the sack, there are a few things that she should do, that you should do, and that the two of you should do together to get ready. Let's start with what she should do. Begin by making an appointment with her healthcare provider for a preconception physical. At the appointment, the doctor will evaluate any and all medications she's taking to make sure they're safe during pregnancy. He or she will probably prescribe prenatal vitamins and possibly folic acid supplements. Folic acid lowers the risk of some birth defects of the brain and spinal cord. The doctor will address any medical conditions such as diabetes, asthma, high blood pressure, depression, epilepsy, obesity, or any problems with previous pregnancies. All of these reduce her ability to get pregnant, and if she does conceive, can increase pregnancy complications and the risk of miscarriage, preterm delivery, and birth defects. The doc will make sure her immunizations are up to date, in particular chickenpox, German measles, and hepatitis B. The doctor will screen your partner for sexually transmitted diseases and will discuss the birth control methods she's been using. If she's been on the pill, she may need to go through a couple of pill 3 months before trying to conceive. Next, she should get healthy. According to the CDC, 11% of women smoke during pregnancy and 10% consume alcohol. Of women who could get pregnant, 69% don't take folic acid supplements, 31% are obese, and about 3% take prescription or over-the-counter drugs that are known to interfere with fetal development or to cause birth defects. Getting healthy means she'll need to limit caffeine. Some studies show that caffeine can decrease a woman's fertility and increase the risk of miscarriage or other problems. Other studies find no connection. Just to be safe, though, it's probably best if she cuts back to no more than 2 or 3 cups of coffee per day or switches to decaf. She'll need to exercise. It's much better for a pregnant woman to continue an exercise routine she already has in place than to start a new one. If your partner hasn't been working out regularly, add this to the list of things to talk about with her healthcare provider. She'll need to watch her weight. If she's overweight, her doctor, of course, will tell her whether it's a problem or not. Now is the time to start slimming down. She definitely doesn't want to be dieting during the pregnancy. According to the CDC, reaching a healthy weight before pregnancy reduces the risks of neural tube defects, preterm delivery, diabetes, cesarean section, and other conditions associated with obesity. She'll need to pay attention to diet and nutrition. What your partner eats immediately before conception and in the first days and weeks of the pregnancy can have a big impact on fetal development and the baby's long-term health. She'll need to quit smoking and drinking. Both decrease fertility and increase the chance of premature or low birth weight delivery or pregnancy loss. Finally, she'll need to stay out of hot tubs. A recent study by healthcare giant Kaiser Permanente found that women who used a hot tub after conception were twice as likely to miscarry as women who didn't. Other studies haven't found much of a connection, but Kaiser's lead researcher, D. Kun Lee, recommends that women in the early stages of pregnancy and those who may have conceived but aren't sure might want to play it safe for the first few months and avoid hot tubs as a way of reducing unnecessary risk of miscarriage. Now let's take a look at what you should do to increase fertility. Start by talking to your doctor. Give him your medical history and tell him about your plans to do the dad thing. You want to find out whether there are any issues that you need to address before you start planning those romantic, candlelit, birth control-free evenings. One especially important topic you'll want to discuss is how to make sure your sperm is healthy. Here are some ways to do that. Keep your balls cool. Sperm is very sensitive to heat, which is why your testicles, where those little swimmers of yours live, hang outside your body, where it's a few degrees cooler. Heating them up by as few as a couple degrees, say by spending any more than 5 minutes in a hot tub or hot bath, sitting with your legs crossed for extended periods of time, or wearing tight underwear, could reduce sperm production or cause abnormalities. We all know that women have fertility cycles, but were you aware that we do too? Turns out that sperm are on a 90-day cycle, meaning that whatever happens to them today won't show up for 3 months or so. Call in the Vice Squad. Smoking, using illegal drugs or misusing legal ones, and drinking alcohol have all been linked to lowered fertility, miscarriage, and birth defects. Watch the toxins. Hazardous chemicals, pesticides, and even noxious fumes could damage sperm, and if you inadvertently bring them home, for example on your clothes, they could hurt your partner too. Lose some weight. Dr. A. Giyath Shaib from the University of Aberdeen, Scotland, found that obese men produce lower volumes of seminal fluid, that's the liquid that carries the sperm, and they have a higher proportion of abnormal sperm. Men who are trying for a baby with their partners should first try to achieve an ideal body weight, says Shaib. Have a little more fun. Traditional thinking has it that if you want to improve your chances of getting your partner pregnant, you should not ejaculate for at least a couple of days before trying. But Australian OB David Greening disagrees. Greening studied men with DNA-damaged sperm. After 7 days of ejaculating daily, no, it didn't matter how, the percentage of damaged sperm dropped significantly, and motility, that's a measure of how straight and how quickly sperm swim toward those ever-elusive eggs, increased. Finally, hang out with some dads. Talk to other guys about what it's like to be a dad, the challenges they faced, and how they overcame them. Ask a ton of questions. As I mentioned, there are some things that both you and your partner should do. Make sure you've discussed any possible medical issues with a qualified healthcare provider. If you haven't already, talk over any and all pregnancy-related risk factors. These include her age. Getting pregnant at 35 or older increases the risk of certain genetic abnormalities, such as Down syndrome. Your age. Family history. Could either of you be a carrier of any genetic disorders, birth defects, or conditions such as cystic fibrosis or hemophilia? Belonging to a high-risk ethnic group. African Americans may want to be tested for sickle cell anemia. Individuals of African or Mediterranean descent may want to be tested for thalassemia. Jews of Ashkenazi, that's Eastern European, descent may want to be tested for Tay-Sachs and or Canavan disease. Take a quick look at your HR manual and investigate your family leave options. We'll talk about this more when we get to the sixth month. But the more time you have to prepare yourself and your employer, the better. Look at your finances. How are you going to pay for all this? Do you have insurance? If so, check your deductibles and copays and whether you have maternity coverage at all. If you or she just started a job, does the policy have a waiting period before benefits kick in? If you don't have insurance, what are your options? Could you qualify for Medicaid? Sit down with your partner and have some serious discussions about your plans. Hopefully, she'll get pregnant at the perfect time. But if that doesn't happen, how do you feel about fertility treatments? Would you consider artificial insemination using your sperm? Would you consider using donor sperm? How about in vitro fertilization? What about using donor eggs? And if you do use any kind of technology, are you prepared to parent twins or more? Don't try to resolve anything in a single conversation. Pregnancy after a miscarriage. Getting pregnant after having lost a baby can bring up a jumble of feelings for both you and your partner. For example, you'll probably be feeling incredibly happy that you're expecting again, but you may also be worried that this pregnancy will end the same way the last one did. That could keep you from allowing yourself to become truly engaged in and enjoy the pregnancy, at least until you're after the point when the miscarriage happened last time. If your partner is feeling this, she may deliberately keep herself from bonding with the baby, trying to save herself the grief if the worst happens again. If it's been a while since the miscarriage, you might be angry in an abstract sort of way that you're still expecting when by all rights you should be holding a baby in your arms right now. But if your partner got pregnant right away, you might be feeling guilty at not having let an appropriate amount of time pass, whatever that means. Everyone deals with post-miscarriage pregnancy differently, but there are a few things that may make it easier. Try not to worry. It may have happened before, but chances are it won't happen again. Only one in about 200 women are what's called recurrent miscarriers, meaning that they have had three miscarriages and have never delivered a child. Don't pay attention to other people's horror stories. You'd be amazed at how insensitive some people can be. Don't tell anyone about the pregnancy until you're absolutely ready to, and then tell only people you'd want to support you if something bad were to happen. Get some more ultrasounds or listen to the heartbeat. This might help reassure you that all is well. Get some support. If your partner can help you, great, but she may be preoccupied with her own thoughts. Otherwise, find someone else who's been there and tell him or her how you're feeling. Finally, support your partner. Encourage her to talk about what she's feeling and don't make any judgments about what she says. And try to keep her calm. As the pregnancy progresses, for example, and she can feel the baby's movements, she may become fixated on counting them, worried that there are either too many or too few. Just so you know, anywhere from 50 to 1,000 a day is normal. Birth defects. If one of the tests I discussed earlier in this chapter indicates that your baby will be born with a deformity or with any kind of serious disorder, you and your partner have some big discussions ahead of you. There are two basic options for dealing with birth defects in an unborn child: keep the baby or terminate the pregnancy. Fortunately, you and your partner won't have to make this decision on your own. Every hospital that administers diagnostic tests has specially trained genetic counselors who will help you sort through the options. There's no question that the availability of genetic testing has changed the landscape with regard to birth defects. Two recent studies analyzed birth data from a 15 to 20 year period. One found a slight increase in the number of Down syndrome births, the other a slight decrease. As we've discussed, more and more women are putting off childbirth. And since women over 35 are about 5 times more likely than those in their 20s to have a Down syndrome baby, researchers would have expected the number of births to double. The reason that didn't happen is quite simple. With genetic testing able to identify Down syndrome babies very early in the pregnancy, many couples are choosing abortion. If you're considering terminating the pregnancy for genetic reasons, remember that communicating clearly and effectively with your partner is probably the most important thing you can do during this stressful time. The decision you make should not be taken lightly. It's a choice that will last a lifetime, and you and your partner must fully agree before proceeding with either option. But ultimately, your partner should make the final decision. Coping with your grief. If you and your partner choose to terminate your pregnancy or reduce the number of fetuses, or if the pregnancy ends in miscarriage, the emotional toll can be devastating. That's why it's critical for the two of you to seek out the emotional support you're entitled to as soon as possible. While there's nothing that can be done to prepare for or prevent a miscarriage, telling your partner how you feel, either alone or with a member of the clergy, a therapist, or a close friend, is very important. And don't just sit back and wait for her to tell you what she's feeling. Take the initiative, be supportive, and ask a lot of questions. Avoid the temptation to try to fix things. You can't. And don't try to console your wife with statements like, "We can always have another one." Your intentions are good, but it won't go over well. You and your partner do not have to handle your grief by yourselves. Counseling and support are available to both women and men who have lost a fetus through miscarriage, genetic termination, or selective reduction. Going to a support group can be a particularly important experience for men, especially those who aren't getting the support they need from their friends and family. Many men who attend support groups report that until they joined the group, no one had ever asked how they felt about their loss. The group setting can also give men the chance to escape the loneliness and isolation and stop being strong for their partners for a few minutes and grieve for themselves. If you'd like to find a support group, your doctor or the genetic counselors can refer you to the closest one, or the one that might be the most sympathetic to men's concerns. Some men, however, are not at all interested in getting together with a large group of people who have little in common but tragedy. If you feel this way, be sure to explain your feelings tactfully to your partner. She may feel quite strongly that you should be there with her, and she might feel rejected if you aren't. If you ultimately decide not to join a support group, don't try to handle things alone. Talk to your partner, your doctor, your cleric, or a sympathetic friend, or read or maybe contribute to some of the blogs that deal with grief from the dad's perspective. Keeping your grief bottled up will only hinder the healing process. We've covered a lot of information in this chapter, and I know that some of it was a little depressing. Just so you know, I'm not trying to scare you by telling you all this. Over the years, I've interviewed over 1,000 expectant and new dads, and the vast majority have told me that they'd rather have at least a basic understanding of some of the not-so-great things that could happen than get completely blindsided by them later on. Let's move on to the third month. I promise it'll be a lot cheerier than this one was. The third month, spreading the word. What's going on with the baby? By now, the little fetus looks pretty much like a real person, except that he or she, even a really sharp ultrasound technician would be hard-pressed to tell you which, is only about 2 or 3 inches long, weighs less than an ounce, and has translucent skin and a gigantic head, although gigantic is a relative term, it's roughly the size of a grape now. All the internal organs are there. Teeth, fingernails, toenails, and hair are developing nicely, and the brain is not far behind. By the end of this month, the baby will be breathing amniotic fluid and will be able to curl its toes, turn its head, open and close its mouth, and even frown. What's going on with your partner? Physically, she's experiencing some relief. Fatigue, morning sickness, breast tenderness, and some other early pregnancy symptoms are beginning to disappear. She doesn't look pregnant yet, but she's having trouble fitting into her clothes anyway. Emotionally, she's experiencing a heightened sense of reality about the pregnancy from hearing the baby's heartbeat. She may still be ambivalent about the pregnancy and may wonder how she is ever going to get through the next 6 months. She's frustrated or possibly excited over her thickening waistline. She's still moody and is beginning to turn inward, focusing on what's happening inside her. And she's beginning to bond with the baby. What's going on with you? A heightened sense of reality. During the third month, the pregnancy begins to feel a little more tangible. By far, the biggest reality booster for me was hearing the baby's heartbeat, even though it didn't sound anything like a real heart at all. It was more like a fast whoosh, whoosh, whoosh sound. Somehow, having the doctor tell us that what we were hearing was really a heartbeat, and a healthy one at that, was mighty reassuring. Ambivalence. Most expectant dads have moments, or weeks, or months, when they're less than completely excited about the pregnancy. Some are petrified that something terrible will happen to their partner or the baby, or that they'll be stuck in traffic on the way to the hospital and they'll have to deliver the baby all by themselves on the side of the road. Some see the whole thing as an inconvenience or a never-ending suck of time and money. Others don't like the idea that they might lose their sex life, their youth, their independence, their friends, their savings, and that coveted spot at the center of their partner's universe. A lot of times, these feelings of ambivalence or lack of interest are followed by guilt for not being more supportive, or not being a better spouse, or fear that these less than warm and fuzzy feelings are a surefire sign that you'll be a lousy dad. Give yourself a break, will ya? There are a number of factors that can increase or decrease these feelings of ambivalence. Is your partner the woman of your dreams, or were you pressured into your relationship? Similarly, is this the relationship of a lifetime, or do you have a feeling that it's not going to last? Are you totally ready to be a dad, or do you feel blindsided by the pregnancy? Have you accomplished everything you wanted to accomplish at this stage of your life, or are you sitting on a bunch of unfulfilled dreams? Are you financially ready for fatherhood, whatever that means to you, or are you worried about money? As you can probably guess, the more ambivalence you feel, the less you'll be involved during the rest of the pregnancy and after your baby is born. Feeling left out. While becoming more aware of the reality of the pregnancy is certainly a good thing, it's not the only thing that you'll be feeling around this point. Toward the end of this first trimester, your partner will probably begin to spend a lot of time concentrating on what's happening inside her body, wondering whether she'll be a good enough mother, and establishing a bond with the baby. She may be worried about the baby's health or concerned that every little ache and pain she feels is the sign of some horrible disease. She's probably internalizing her feelings about all this and may become a little self-absorbed. And if she has a close relationship with her mother, the two of them may develop a deeper bond as your partner tries to find good role models. Everything she's going through at this point is completely normal. The danger, however, is that while your partner is turning inward, spending more time with her girlfriends or bonding with her own mother and baby, you may end up feeling left out, rejected, or even pushed out of the way. This can be particularly painful, but no matter how much it hurts, resist the urge to retaliate by withdrawing from her. Be as comforting as you can be, and let her know in a non-confrontational way how you're feeling. Fortunately, this period of turning inward won't last forever. Excluded or welcomed by your partner's practitioners. For some men, especially those who are feeling emotionally left out by their partners, the joy they experience at the increasing reality of the pregnancy can be outweighed by the bitterness they feel at the way they're treated by their partner's doctors. Pamela Jordan, a nurse and a pregnancy expert, found that most men feel that their presence at prenatal visits is perceived as cute or novel. I frequently hear from expectant dads that medical professionals have a tendency to treat them as if they're mere onlookers or intruders and consider their partners the only ones worth interacting with. If they were talked to at all during visits, it was only to discuss how to support their partners. The fact that an expectant dad might have very specific, unique, and important needs and concerns didn't seem to occur to anyone. If you are interested in being involved and your partner's practitioner isn't as welcoming as you'd like, I can just about guarantee that your experience of the whole pregnancy will be tainted. Whether you realize it or not, you probably have some pretty clear ideas about how you'd like the pregnancy and birth to go. If you're reduced to the role of spectator, you're not going to get what you want, and you're going to feel stressed and resentful. That will influence your level of involvement throughout the rest of the pregnancy and will make it a lot harder to adjust to all the changes that new fatherhood will bring. I don't mean to suggest that this kind of thing happens everywhere or that the fault always lies entirely with the medical staff. A lot of guys feel a little squeamish around or just plain put off by gynecological stuff, and they hide in the corner to avoid having to deal with it. And if your partner has a male OB, it can also be a little odd to be in the room while another guy has his hands in places you thought were off limits to everyone but you. Yes, pelvic exams are a standard medical procedure, and if you go to enough appointments, you'll get used to them, but still. Fortunately, more and more medical professionals, but not nearly enough, are welcoming dads into the fold. In my case, over the course of 3 pregnancies, all of the OBs went out of their way to include me in the process. They made a special point of looking at me when talking about what was happening with my wife and baby. They encouraged me to ask questions and answered them thoroughly. Part of the reason for this was that from the very beginning, I made it clear that I wanted to be involved, and I peppered them with questions, so it was pretty much impossible for them to ignore me. I suggest that you do the same, especially if you have even the slightest suspicion that your partner's practitioner is ignoring you or not taking you seriously. Our first OB even invited me to take a look at my wife's cervix. I was a little put off by the idea, but getting to see the cervix, through which our baby would emerge just 6 months later, somehow made the pregnancy seem less mysterious and made me feel much more a part of the whole thing. At the same time, I've got to admit that the experience was a little odd. If your OB doesn't offer you a look, ask for one, but expect some raised eyebrows. And be sure to ask your partner first. She might feel that it's more than a bit intrusive, especially since it's a part of her body that she may never see. Plus, she may simply not want anyone but her practitioner looking at her in such a clinical way. Can't blame her for that one. Physical symptoms, couvade. Although most of what you'll be going through during your pregnancy will be psychological, don't be surprised if you start developing some physical symptoms as well. Various studies estimate that as many as 90% of American expectant fathers experience couvade syndrome. That's from the French word meaning to hatch, also called sympathetic pregnancy. Couvade symptoms are typically the same as those traditionally associated with pregnant women: weight gain, nausea, mood swings, food cravings, as well as some not necessarily associated with pregnant women: headaches, toothaches, itching, diarrhea, even cysts. Symptoms, if you're going to have them at all, usually appear in about the 3rd month of pregnancy, decrease for a few months, then pick up again in the month or two before the baby is born. In almost every case, though, the symptoms mysteriously disappear at the birth. Here are some of the most common reasons an expectant father might develop couvade symptoms. Sympathy or feelings of guilt for what the woman is going through. Men have traditionally been socialized to bite the bullet when it comes to pain and discomfort. When our loved ones are suffering and we can't do anything to stop it, our naturally and slightly irrational instinct is to try to take their pain away, to make it ours instead of theirs. This is especially true if we have even the slightest feeling, no matter how crazy, that we're responsible for the pain in the first place. If your partner has been suffering from morning sickness or has had any other pregnancy-related difficulties, you and she may feel that it's your fault. And if her symptoms have been particularly rough, she might even reinforce your subconscious guilt by reminding you that you're the one who got her into all this in the first place. Jealousy. There's no question that your partner is going to be getting a lot more attention during the pregnancy than you are. And some men who develop Couvade symptoms undoubtedly do so in a subconscious attempt to shift the focus of the pregnancy to themselves. It's as if they're saying, "Hey, she's not the only one around her who's tossing her cookies," or, "Excuse me, but my pants aren't fitting so well anymore either." My father, who was pacing the waiting room while my mother was in labor with me, suddenly got a gushing nosebleed. Within seconds, the delivery room was empty, except for my mother, as three nurses and two doctors raced out to take care of my poor bleeding father. I'm sure he didn't do it on purpose, but for one brief moment during the delivery, Dad was the complete center of attention. Similarly, physical symptoms could be a kind of public way of asserting paternity. Although it's not exactly a Couvade symptom, a lot of expectant dads take up hobbies or begin projects that allow them to create something new, just like their partner's doing. Your hormones could be raging. No, I haven't got that backwards. While she's pregnant, several of your partner's hormone levels gradually rise. These include prolactin, which helps get her breast ready to lactate, that's produce milk, and cortisol, which appears to be associated with parent-child bonding. It used to be that everyone thought these hormone changes were triggered by the developing fetus, but in several fascinating studies, researcher Anne Story and her colleagues found something that may change a few minds. Story took blood samples from expectant mothers and fathers at various points during the pregnancy and found that expectant dads' level of cortisol and prolactin, which you wouldn't think guys would even have, paralleled their partners. The differences for mums were much more drastic, but the patterns were similar, said Dr. Story, who's Canadian, hence the cute mums instead of moms. Some guys seem to be more susceptible to this kind of thing than others. In talking with the men in her study, Story found that those who had experienced tiredness, weight gain, changes in appetite, or any other physical Couvade symptoms had higher than average levels of prolactin and lower than average levels of testosterone compared to expectant dads who didn't have these symptoms. Fortunately, this doesn't mean that you'll be developing breasts anytime soon. Like your partners, your hormone levels will return to normal not long after your baby is born, and your manliness will remain intact. These hormone changes could also contribute to an extremely common non-physical type of Couvade symptom. Most expectant dads find themselves somewhat more interested in children than before the pregnancy. Is it simply curiosity, or is it the body's way of preparing the expectant dad for his changing responsibilities? Hard to say, but studies have shown that the stronger an expectant dad's Couvade symptoms, the better he'll care for his newborn. Maybe there's something about sharing, sort of, the physical part of pregnancy that helps develop the dad-baby bond. If any of this is hitting home, though, you may want to think twice before you let your partner listen to this chapter, especially if you've been making fun of her out-of-control hormones. If none of this is hitting home, that's fine, too. There are no rules about how you're supposed to be feeling. Good old-fashioned stress. Researcher Robert Rodriguez cites evidence that men with unplanned pregnancies seem to have more symptoms than others, and that working-class men, who presumably are more likely to be worrying about money, have more frequent symptoms than middle-class dads. You may be sending messages to your partner. Generally speaking, women are more vulnerable during pregnancy and parenthood than men. You can always take a break. She can't. At the risk of sounding politically incorrect, a number of researchers have speculated that this is precisely why women have traditionally looked for men who will be good providers. As a result, expectant mothers are often particularly concerned about whether their partners are going to be there for them and whether they're really committed to being fathers. On one level, you can reassure your partner by telling her you love her, by going to all the prenatal doctor appointments, and by educating yourself and staying as involved as you possibly can. But words aren't always enough. Some evolutionary psychologists have speculated recently that on a far more subconscious level, Expectant dads' physical couvade symptoms could be a chemically driven way of showing their partners just how committed they truly are. After all, you could be lying when you tell her you love her and that you're excited about being a dad, but it's a lot harder to fake a nosebleed or a backache or a new potbelly. In short, your physical symptoms may be nature's way of giving your partner a way to evaluate your true feelings about her and the baby, as well as your reliability as a partner and fellow parent. A little history. Most researchers today agree that in Western societies, couvade symptoms appear unconsciously in those expectant fathers who experience them. But as far back as 60 BCE and continuing today in many non-Western societies, couvade has been used deliberately in rituals designed to keep fathers involved in the experience of pregnancy and childbirth. Not all of these rituals, however, have been particularly friendly to women. W.R. Dawson writes that in the first century CE, mothers were routinely ignored during childbirth while their husbands were waited on in bed. And more recently, in Spain and elsewhere, mothers frequently gave birth in the fields where they worked. Then they returned home to care for the baby's father. But in other cultures, men tried to do the same thing they try to do today, take their partner's pain away by attracting it to themselves. In France and Germany, for example, pregnant women were given their husbands' clothes during labor in the belief that doing so would transfer the wives' pains to their husband. Perhaps the most bizarre couvade ritual I've come across is one that enabled dads-to-be to literally share the pain of childbirth. Apparently, the Huichol people of Mexico used to position the dad in a tree or on the roof above his laboring wife. Ropes were tied around his testicles, and with each contraction, she could yank on the ropes and give her husband a taste of what she was going through. Seems a little much to me, but I'm sure there are plenty of women who would disagree. Perhaps the most interesting aspect of ritual couvade is the importance attached to the supernatural bond between the father and the unborn child. Whatever the fathers did during pregnancy was believed to have a direct impact on the unborn child. In Borneo, expectant fathers ate nothing but rice and salt, a diet that was said to keep a new baby's stomach from swelling. In other countries, a man who hammered a nail while his wife was pregnant was thought to be dooming her to a long, painful labor, and if he split wood, he would surely have a child with a cleft lip. Afraid of making his own child blind, an expectant father wouldn't eat meat from an animal that gives birth to blind young. He also avoided turtles so that his child would not be born deaf with deformed limbs or flippers and anencephalic with a cone-shaped head. While it's pretty doubtful that couvade rituals actually reduced any woman's childbirth pains or prevented any deformities, they do illustrate an important point. Men have been trying to get and stay involved in pregnancy and childbirth for thousands of years. As Bronislaw Malinowski noted in his 1927 book Sex and Repression in Savage Society, even the apparently absurd idea of couvade presents to us a deep meaning and a necessary function. It is of high biological value for the human family to consist of both father and mother. If the traditional customs and rules are there to establish a social situation of close moral proximity between father and child, if all such customs aim at drawing a man's attention to his offspring, then the couvade, which makes man simulate the birth pangs and illness of maternity, is of great value and provides the necessary stimulus and expression for paternal tendencies. The couvade and all the customs of its type serve to accentuate the principle of legitimacy, the child's need of a father. Couvade for adoptive and ART dads, too? Yep. Given that couvade symptoms seem to be an expression of fathers' desires to get some confirmation of their special status in their children's lives, it shouldn't come as much of a surprise that adoptive fathers often experience them as well. In fact, according to adoption educator Patricia Irwin Johnson, sympathetic symptoms of pregnancy are fairly common. One or both partners may experience repeated and even predictably scheduled episodes of nausea, says Johnson. Food cravings and significant weight gain are not unusual. One or both may complain of sleep disturbances or emotional peaks and valleys. Men who are becoming fathers thanks to IVF or some other artificial reproductive technology procedure aren't immune to couvade symptoms either. In fact, some research suggests that fathers who have or whose partner has experienced infertility may actually be more susceptible than dads who conceive naturally. The same may also be true for expectant dads who were adopted as babies. Staying involved. Spilling the beans. Another thing, this month anyway, that will make the pregnancy seem more real is telling other people about it. By the end of the third month, I'd pretty well gotten over my fears of miscarriage or other pregnancy disasters, and we decided it was safe to put the word out to our family and close friends. Somehow just saying, "My wife's pregnant," I switched to "we're expecting" a while later, helped me realize it was true. The decision about when to let other people in on your pregnancy is a big one. Some people are superstitious and opt to put off making the announcement for as long as possible. Others rush to the phone or start emailing, texting, tweeting, and updating their Facebook pages before the urine is even dry on the pregnancy test stick. Even if you're in the first category, sooner or later, you're going to have to start spreading the word, and the end of the third month is a pretty good time. There are, of course, advantages and disadvantages to making either an early or late announcement. For example, if you tell people early, you'll probably get a lot of support, reassurance, referrals, and hand-me-downs. But after a while, you may start looking around for an off switch. If you tell people early and something goes wrong, that support will be there for you. On the other hand, retracting good news is not an easy thing to do. If you decide to tell people later, you'll have complete control over the information flow. You'll keep from drowning in advice, but some of that advice might have been good. And if something were to go wrong, you wouldn't have to worry about retracting the good news, but you wouldn't have as much of a support network to lean on either. Ultimately, whom you decide to tell and in what order is your own business, but here are a few ideas you might want to keep in mind. Let's start with family. Unless you have some compelling reason not to, you should probably tell your family first. Your close friends will forgive you if they hear about the pregnancy from your Aunt Ida. If it happens the other way around, Aunt Ida may take real offense. There are a few cases, however, when telling your family first might not be a great idea. One couple we knew kept their pregnancy a secret from their friends for 5 months and from their family for longer, hoping that the husband's brother and sister-in-law, who had been trying to get pregnant for years, would succeed in the interim. Friends. If you do decide to tell your friends first, don't count on your secret staying a secret for very long. Good news travels a lot faster than you might think, and nothing travels faster or further than a tweet or a Facebook status update. As in the case of relatives, be considerate of friends who have been trying but who haven't been as successful as you. The office. You'll probably want to tell your coworkers and your boss, if you have one, at about the same time as you tell your friends, but remember that society has some pretty rigid work-family rules for men, so be prepared for a less than enthusiastic response from some people. Whatever you do, though, don't wait until the last minute to tell the folks at work, especially if you're planning to take some time off or make any work schedule changes after the birth. Your other children. If you have other children, give them plenty of time to adjust to the news, but don't tell them until after you want everyone else to know. Until they're over 6, kids don't understand the concept of keeping a secret. When she was 4, one of my oldest daughter's big thrills in life was to gleefully whisper in people's ears things that were supposed to be secrets. In her mind, whispering something didn't actually count as saying it. Make a special effort to include your other children as much as possible in the pregnancy experience. Our oldest daughter came with us to most of the doctor appointments and got to hold the Doppler, that's the thing you hear the fetus's heartbeat through, and helped the doctor measure my wife's growing belly. Finally, keep in mind that it's perfectly normal for expectant siblings to insist that they, too, are pregnant just like mommy. Trying to convince them that they're not may make them feel excluded and resentful of the new baby. This is especially true for little boys. A few special circumstances. If your partner had a miscarriage and you're expecting again, the rules, to the extent that there are any, for telling family and friends change somewhat. You might want to tell selected people immediately. You may be craving your family's or friends' support, or you may just need someone to be happy for you. Most people, though, want to put it off as long as possible, although in another month or so it'll be pretty obvious. Here are some common reasons why. You may be worried that there could be another miscarriage and don't want to put yourself through the pain of calling everyone to give them bad news. This is especially true if your partner has had more than one. If your partner got pregnant right after a miscarriage, you may worry that other people will think you're being disrespectful by not grieving longer. You may want to wait until you're over the hump, past the point when the miscarriage happened last time. If you have other kids who know about the previous miscarriage, it's a good idea to wait until the pregnancy is pretty far along. They may worry about your partner or the new baby, and they might even be afraid that something they did caused the first miscarriage. If you have even the slightest inkling that this is the case, spend some time gently explaining to your other children that they are not responsible at all, that sometimes things happen that we just can't explain. Telling friends and family that you've decided to adopt, or that you're doing ART, or that you're using a gestational carrier can be a surprisingly tricky thing. Some couples are perfectly fine with the idea, but for most, it's a lot more complicated. To start with, you or your partner might be ashamed of what you consider the inadequacy of not being able to get pregnant naturally. And then there's the grief one or both of you may feel. Depending on which options you're considering, you may have to come to terms with the loss of your dreams of having a biologically related child and keeping your genetic line alive, or the disappointment at being deprived of the opportunity to go through a pregnancy and birth. Although you'd think everyone would be overjoyed at your decision to adopt, or if you're using donor sperm or eggs, to tell people about it, that's not always the case. Some people, especially relatives, might not be too happy that you're bringing in an outsider into your family. You have every right to expect your family to honor your decision and treat you and your partner with respect. At the same time, as Patricia Irwin Johnson points out, your family has the right to expect certain things from you, including information. They can't be sensitive about something they don't understand. You might want to recommend that they read some books on adoption. There are a number of excellent adoption-related resources in the PDF. Sensitivity. You must acknowledge that your decision to adopt might cause some people some pain. Your parents, for example, might be disappointed that they're not going to become grandparents the right way, or that a genetic family link has been broken. Like you, they may need some time to mourn the loss of their hopes and dreams. Patience. Even if they do have information and a good understanding of adoption, they're still lagging behind you and your partner in terms of knowledge. So give them some time to catch up and don't expect instant support and understanding. If someone makes a dumb or insensitive remark about adoption or donor sperm or anything else, resist the urge to bite her head off. Instead, take her aside and point out the mistake as nicely as you can. What if you're not married? Even in the 21st century, when it's the norm for couples to live together before getting married, having a child out of wedlock still raises a lot of eyebrows in some circles. Your most liberal-minded friends and relatives might surprise you by suggesting that you make an honest woman of her before the baby comes. Try to keep your sense of humor about these things. You and your partner are grown-ups and capable of making the decisions you think are best. And anyway, most unmarried parents-to-be find that their relatives' joy at the prospect of a new little niece, nephew, or grandchild frequently overshadows those same relatives' disappointment over your lack of a marriage certificate. Trying to keep the secret. Despite your attempts to control the flow of information, if you're not careful about what you do, people, especially your close friends, are going to guess. If you're serious about not wanting anyone to know, here are a couple of things to keep in mind. First, stay away from expressions like, in her condition, or I think she really needs to rest. That's exactly how I inadvertently leaked the news to a friend who had asked how we liked working out on the Stairmaster machine at the gym. Be unobtrusive if you change your habits. If your partner used to drink or smoke before she got pregnant, you might want to think a little about how your friends and family will react to her new vice-free lifestyle, but that's no excuse not to quit smoking or drinking. When my wife was pregnant with our second daughter, we agreed to meet some good friends at a bar one Saturday night. No one really noticed that my wife was drinking mineral water instead of her usual beer, but when she ordered an ice-cold glass of milk, the jig was up. No matter how or when you do it, telling people you're expecting will open a floodgate of congratulations and advice. After a few weeks, you may wonder what anyone used to talk about at parties before. Just about everyone has something to say about what you should and shouldn't do now that you're expecting. You'll hear delightful stories, horror stories, and just plain boring stories about pregnancy and childbirth. You'll probably also have to endure endless jokes about your masculinity, speculation about who the real father is, and questions about what the mailman or the milkman looks like, mostly, unfortunately, from other men. With attitudes like these, is it any wonder that 60% of men have at least fleeting doubts as to the true paternity of their children? Immediately after breaking the news to our friends and family, my wife and I began to feel some slight changes in our relationship with them. What had once been our private secret was now public knowledge, and just about everyone wanted to share it with us. People would drop in unannounced, usually bearing either gifts or advice, just to see how things were going. And the phone never stopped ringing. After a few days, you and your partner may start to feel a little claustrophobic. If this happens, don't hesitate to establish some ground rules. For example, you might want to ask your friends and family to call before coming over, or you might set up and let everyone know about specific visiting hours. You should also prepare yourself for the possibility that you may feel a little left out. Most people are going to be asking how your partner is feeling, what she's going through, and so on. Few, if any, will ask you the same questions. If you start feeling that you're being treated more like a spectator than a participant in the pregnancy, there are three basic solutions. First, you can just ignore the whole thing. No one's deliberately trying to exclude you. It just doesn't occur to most people that pregnancy, at least at this stage, affects men all that much. Second, you can sulk. This, although it's sometimes satisfying, will probably not get you the kind of attention you're craving. Third, you can take a proactive role and volunteer information about how the pregnancy is affecting you. Tell people about how excited you are, how much weight you've put on, and how bad those stomach aches are you've been having. Confide your hopes and fears to your friends, especially those who already have kids and can offer advice. If you're lucky, they'll start asking you for updates. Your relationship with each other. Pregnancy is not only a time of great joy and anticipation, it's also a time of great stress. And even though you and your partner are both pregnant at the same time, you're not experiencing the pregnancy in exactly the same way or at the same pace. This can lead to an increasing number of misunderstandings and conflicts. As Gerald Shapiro writes, when a couple becomes a family, generally all the things that are good get better, and all the things that are bad get worse. As your pregnancy continues, then, it's critical to learn to talk and listen to each other and to find ways to help each other through this marvelous but emotionally bumpy experience. As men, we've been conditioned to try to protect our partners from harm. And when our partners are pregnant, protecting them may include trying to minimize the levels of stress in their life. One way we do this is by not talking about our own concerns. Somewhere along the line, we got this idea that being strong for our partners means not ever acknowledging how much the pregnancy and the whole transition to fatherhood is affecting us. Researchers Carolyn and Philip Cowan found that this overprotective, macho attitude has some very negative side effects. First, because we never give ourselves the chance to talk about our fears and concerns, we never learn that what we're going through is normal and healthy. Second, our partners never get the chance to find out that we understand and share their feelings. As a result, instead of decreasing stress around the house, we end up increasing it for her and for ourselves. There's also some evidence that there are other benefits to talking about how you're feeling and getting your partner's support for those feelings. Researcher Geraldine Dimer found that men who receive their partner's emotional support during pregnancy have better physical and emotional health and are better able to maintain good relationships with their spouses than men who don't get that kind of support. Speaking of talking to each other, here's an important homework assignment for you. In the first year after the birth of their baby, 90% of couples in researcher Jay Belsky's studies experienced a tremendous drop-off in the quality and quantity of their communication. Half the time, it was permanent. If you think about this, it makes perfectly good sense. Right now, besides being in a relationship together, you and your partner have your own individual lives, hobbies, friends, jobs, and interests. You're both growing and developing as people, as individuals, and as a couple. That's what has made you the lovable guy you are and the lovable woman she is. But once your baby shows up, you're going to be making an abrupt change to the all baby, all the time channel, constantly thinking about, talking about, and doing things with your baby. All that personal growth stuff is going out the window, at least for a while. The cure for this is to set aside 15 minutes every day to talk about something, anything other than the baby. I know this sounds awfully simple, but if you get into the habit now while your life is still relatively calm, you'll be taking a huge step towards keeping your relationship fresh. It really does work, and making a commitment to doing it every day is absolutely critical. The more satisfied you feel in your relationship before you have children, according to researchers Chin Yan Lee and William Doherty, the more time you'll spend with your child during the first year of his or her life. Dangerous assumptions. When I was in the Marines, one of my drill instructors' favorite comments was, "Never assume anything. Assuming makes an ass out of you and me." The sergeant's spelling problems notwithstanding, and keep in mind this is a guy who also thought habitual thieves were called hypochondriacs and that Italians ate biscotti, he was right about the dangers of making assumptions. Here are a few important things you may have assumed were no problem but could end up biting you in the butt. Not all these issues are important to everybody, but if you haven't discussed them already, do it now. A lot of couples avoid bringing up these issues because they're afraid it'll lead to a fight. And no one wants to upset a pregnant woman, right? Well, in my view, it's better to talk about these things now, a little at a time, than to seethe about them for the next 6 months and then have some kind of explosion. Because these issues are so important, give yourself partial credit toward that 15 minutes a day homework assignment I just gave you. The first item is your involvement in the pregnancy. Dr. Catherine Antle May has found that there are three basic types of father involvement during pregnancy. The observer father maintains a certain emotional distance and sees himself largely as a bystander. The expressive father is emotionally very involved and sees himself as a full partner. The instrumental father sees himself as the manager of the pregnancy and may feel the need to plan every medical appointment, every meal, and every trip to the gym. Whatever your style is, make sure to talk it over with your partner. After all, she's pregnant too. Be aware that there's also a direct correlation between your level of involvement in the pregnancy, as perceived by your partner, and her satisfaction with your relationship. That's according to Suzanne Beal, who's a social psychologist at DePaul University. Also, be aware that her definition of involvement may not be the same as yours. For example, you may consider providing financially for your growing family as involvement, while she may not. You'll also want to discuss your involvement in family tasks. How much childcare are you planning to do when the baby comes? How much is your partner expecting you to do? How much are you expecting her to do? This is going to sound harsh, but the reality is that you'll be as involved with your children as your partner will let you be. If she wants you to take an active role in childcare, chances are you'll want the same thing. But if she wants to keep those activities to herself, you'll probably be less involved. In addition, the Cowans have found that men who take a more active role in running their households and rearing their children tend to feel better about themselves and about their family relationships than men who are less involved in family work. Religion. Both you and your partner may never have given a thought to the religious education, if any, you plan to give your child. If you have thought about it, make sure you're both still thinking along the same lines. If you haven't, this might be a good time to start. Discipline styles. How do you feel about spanking your children? Never? Sometimes? How does she feel about it? How you were raised and whether your parents spanked you will have a great deal to do with how you raise your own children. Sleeping arrangements. It's never too early to give some thought to where you want the baby to sleep. In your bed? In a bassinet next to you? In a separate room? Be prepared, though. Things have a way of changing after the baby shows up. Work and childcare expectations. Is your partner planning to take some time off after the birth before going back to work? How long? Would you like to be able to take some more time off? How long? What types of childcare arrangements do you and she envision? Finances. Do you need two paychecks to pay the mortgage? If you can get by on one, whose will it be? And throughout the pregnancy, don't forget your feelings, good, bad, or indifferent. Talk about your excitement about having a child, your dreams, your plans for the future, your fears, worries, and ambivalence, and how satisfied you are with your level of involvement during the pregnancy. Don't forget to ask your partner.